is with profound disappointment that I, and sadness, that I announce the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott resigned suddenly today, citing inappropriate comments. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 16th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, it's still unclear what Mallott's resignation means for Walker's campaign, with the election just 3 weeks away.
They're in a lot of trouble right now. I think it's going to be really hard to distance yourself from whatever allegations there are.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Byron Mallott abruptly resigned today as lieutenant governor over, quote, inappropriate comments, end quote, he recently made. State Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson has been sworn in to replace him. Mallott also resigned from the campaign seeking a new term on a ticket with Governor Bill Walker. It's too late to remove Mallott's name from the ballot, but the campaign says Davidson would also serve as lieutenant governor if Walker is reelected. Governor Walker has been close to Mallott. He talks frequently about their constant contact and collaboration.
It is with profound disappointment that I, and sadness, that I announce the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott. Byron recently made some inappropriate comments that do not reflect the stellar level of behavior required in his role as Lieutenant Governor.
Walker would not take questions at a press conference today in Anchorage. His office has not said what Mallott said, who he said it to, or discussed the nature of his comments. A Walker spokeswoman said the governor's office, quote, the governor's office's, quote, utmost concern is protection of the victim's privacy, end quote. But Walker emphasized the seriousness of the matter.
As leaders, we really need to hold ourselves with the highest standards, and that was not the case.
The lieutenant governor oversees elections, but has few other official duties. But Mallott has been unusually visible in the role. He was the Democratic nominee for governor 4 years ago, before he merged his campaign with Walker's. In his resignation letter, Mallott said his resignation was, quote, compelled by inappropriate comments I made that placed a person whom I respect and revere in a position of vulnerability, end quote. He did not say to whom he was referring. Mallott wrote in the letter that he takes full responsibility for this action and apologizes to the person he says he hurt. Mallott told Walker in the letter that he recognizes that his actions have compromised Walker's ability to lead the state, quote, for that I express my remorse and sorrow, end quote. Mallott is from Yakutat and is 75 years old. He became mayor of the city when he was 22. He's a clan leader of the Tlingit Raven Quashkequan clan. He was president of the Alaska Federation of Natives and the First Alaskans Institute, and he was chair and executive director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Davidson has led the Department of Health and Social Services since the beginning of Walker's administration. She grew up in Bethel and Aniak.
Alaskans deserve the highest standard of conduct by their elected officials. And while I am deeply saddened by the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, I'm also profoundly disappointed in his conduct. Respect for women and respect for all Alaskans is our responsibility, and I stand ready to serve as your Lieutenant Governor.
Walker appointed Dr. Jay Butler as the new Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. Butler is a host of the Alaska Public Media program Line One, Your Health Connection. Republican candidate for governor Mike Dunleavy says his campaign, quote, remains focused on restoring trust in state government, end quote. Democratic candidate Mark Begich couldn't immediately be reached for comment. The news of Lieutenant Governor Mallott's resignation today has a lot of people wondering what will happen next. That includes Matt Buxton, who is currently the editor of the online blog Midnight Sun. He also covered the legislature for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner during the Walker administration. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, just kind of surprised. And, you know, I wanted to ask you that first, too. What was your reaction to the news today?
I mean, I was shocked. You know, nobody saw this coming. You know, a lot of these things you might hear some rumblings or something like that, but this is out of the blue.
Yeah, we're 3 weeks away from the election. And just, you know, that aside, when you consider sort of the relationship that the governor and lieutenant governor kind of portrayed that they had. How does this seem to indicate some huge blow up between the two of them?
I mean, that's the next step with a lot of these questions, because, you know, I think a lot of us are going to be wondering about what exactly happened with this, the implications for the state's office and everything like that. But Byron Mallott and Bill Walker, you know, made their election in 2014 off of the unity ticket. They merged. They basically, as they would tell it, you know, they were best friends. You know, that was kind of almost unusual for the governor and the lieutenant governor to be so close. And so it's, when you look at how this plays out over the election, I've been thinking about this over the last, I don't know, hour and a half since it broke. It really does tarnish Walker's bid. I mean, him and Byron have had like a bromance for these last 4 years, and it's really hard to see how Walker and his administration or in his campaign can walk away from this. There's no margin for error in this election right now. So,
remind us how Governor Walker and Byron Mallott became running mates to begin with.
Right now, we're in a three-way election right now for this year. There was the same thing in 2014. You had incumbent Republican Governor Sean Parnell, and then you had the Democratic ticket of Byron Mallott and Hollis French, and the independent ticket of then-Republican Bill Walker and his running mate, Mr. Fleener. There's a deadline basically for when parties can change their tickets and rewrite them and how everything like that before the ballots get printed. A couple days before that happened, they announced that, surprise, that they were going to merge their campaigns. And, you know, that proved to be a really winning strategy. You had kind of a moderate conservative on the top of the ticket with Walker, and you had the Democratic Party coming along with Mallott as the lieutenant governor. And they were able to kind of sweep into the election at that point. So, you know, they ran together and they seemed to be very good friends.
Yeah, and they talked about that, like you said, that they had this close relationship. Politically, though, after this announcement today, the governor hasn't really said what it means for his political future and exactly what it means for the campaign. And, you know, you're going through the possibilities in your head. What are some of those? What are the different ways that this could go?
Well, we're talking about the outcomes of this, right? So at this point in time, Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson has been sworn in as lieutenant governor. The campaign has put out an announcement. The Walker campaign has put out an announcement saying that though Byron Mallott will stay on the ticket because the ballots have already been printed and some people have already voted, that Valerie Davidson will take over that role in complete. You know, so she will, if this ticket, you know, I guess at this point somehow prevails, Valerie Davidson would take over as lieutenant governor. So I say somehow because I think that they're in a lot of trouble right now. I think it's going to be really hard to distance yourself from whatever allegations there are. There's not a whole lot of detail on that. So I think you'll see a lot of the press, as much as I kind of don't like it, we'll start to dig in and try to figure out exactly what was said and what happened there. And so this story will continue to kind of slow burn over the next couple weeks, at least. And so Walker campaign's in a lot of trouble right now. I have heard, you know, the people talk about the possibility of the Walker campaign potentially withdrawing. You know, whatever happens at this point, they'll be on the ticket. You know, they'll be on the ballot. So at anything like that, it would be a symbolic thing.
But even if he decides to withdraw at this point, I mean, like you said, his name's on the ballot. How do you even withdraw at this point, 3 weeks before the election?
Well, they put all their money that they have raised into getting the message out there because, right, like, you know, they'll be on the ballot one way or another. So, you know, I would imagine the way that would play out, and I've seen this happen a few times in local races, and it never really works, but, you know, you put all your energy and effort into getting out there and getting in front of people and saying, I support this other candidate. Go vote for if you support me and support what I am doing or support my candidacy, I now support this other guy. But, you know, again, this is going to be a race with really small margins for error. And so whether or not that actually happens is one question. Whether or not if it does, it's going to be amazing, I guess, if it somehow succeeds in sending enough of those votes over.
Matt Buxton is the editor of the blog Midnight Sun. Thanks for being here, Matt.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has handed a key approval to ConocoPhillips for an oil development on the North Slope west of Prudhoe Bay. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
According to Conoco, the Greater Moses Tooth 2 drill site in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, could produce up to 40,000 barrels of oil per day. The company aims to begin construction this winter and complete the project by 2021. Greater Moses Tooth 2 will be connected to Conoco's Greater Moses Tooth 1 project, which is about 9 miles away. Greater Moses Tooth 1 started producing oil last week and is the first oil development on federal leases in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Conoco now controls the majority of leased federal land in the reserve. And west of the Greater Moses Tooth sites, Conoco is also pursuing an even bigger oil development called the Willow Project. Conoco estimates Willow could produce up to 100,000 barrels per day. That's a full fifth of the amount of oil currently flowing down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
A coalition of 15 Southeast Alaska tribes has endorsed the Stand for Salmon ballot measure. The controversial measure would create stronger protections for anadromous fish streams, primarily salmon. The Southeast Alaska Transboundary Commission was formed to protect Southeast's watersheds from potential mine pollution from British Columbia. The group said in a release that Alaskans cannot criticize mine operators in Canada without being, quote, diligent in keeping our lands and water pristine. Alaska's ballot measure 1 would be on the November ballot. It's opposed by the mining and energy sectors. They argue it would threaten development. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a young tribal chief brings elders and youth to its feet.
We are here today because of our ancestors. The things that they went through so we could be here are unimaginable.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Day 2 of the Elders and Youth Conference is wrapping up at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. The youth keynote address drew a spirited reaction from the audience. 20-year-old Tristan Yado Joven Madros focused on his traditional upbringing in Kaltag, hunting, building birch sleds, sewing skins, and speaking Koyukon Athabaskan. Madros says practices like those need to be at the center of young people's formal education.
We should be incorporating our traditions, our oral histories, and dancing into our curriculum. We should be teaching these things to the children in the schools. You have to start somewhere.
At just 19 years old, Madros was chosen to be second chief on the Kaltag Village Council and works with several different entities in the interior region, including Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission. Madros' speech was brief, about 9 minutes long. His message was clear and direct, asking for elders to serve a more direct role as a bridge for young people to move forward, and telling the current generation to take pride in their heritage.
We are here today because of our ancestors. The things that they went through so we could be here are unimaginable, and we have to respect that by respecting the land they walked on. We must continue to move their footprints around. We shouldn't cover them up with oil rigs, mines, and logging companies. It's time that we realize what we leave behind is what our future generations will have to deal with.
The speech got a standing ovation from the crowd. Day 2 of the conference also heard panels on wellness, hip-hop performances by Indigenous artists, and breakout sessions. Elders and Youth wraps up tomorrow, with the Alaska Federation of Natives beginning Thursday and lasting through Saturday. A female police officer filed a sexual harassment complaint against the Sitka Police Department on Thursday. 32-year-old Mary Ferguson alleges that throughout her time on the force, she was treated differently because of her gender and subject to sexual harassment by male officers. This is the second lawsuit filed against the department in less than 2 months. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports on the case and the questions it raises about workplace culture for women within the Sitka Police Department.
The 18-page brief chronicles her experiences working there and seeks both compensatory and punitive damages. The problems began in the fall of 2015, when Ferguson was sworn in as an officer. A sergeant was put in charge of her training and had to accompany Ferguson during long patrol shifts. Within weeks, Ferguson alleges he began sending her flirtatious text messages, unsolicited. She responded noncommittally. Her complaint says she feared for her job if she rebuffed the sergeant's advances. Then one day, in January 2016, while working the night shift, Ferguson alleges the sergeant propositioned her and said he wanted to kiss her. She tried to move away from him within the patrol car and said, "Please don't." The complaint says the sergeant did not force himself on Ferguson, and he asked her not to report his misconduct to more senior managers. After completing her training in March 2016, Ferguson says she felt safe to report those events to Jeff Ankerfeldt, then a lieutenant and now the chief of police. But she claims that Ankerfeldt did not take action. As for the sergeant, he was later promoted to lieutenant and is expected to retire at the end of the month. In the years that followed, Ferguson alleges a string of, quote, nonstop gender discrimination. The discrimination portion of her complaint talks about one lieutenant in particular who has made multiple comments and judgment calls based on Ferguson's gender. Ferguson took these complaints to Chief Ankerfeldt on two occasions, but alleges nothing was done. So in June of this year, she brought her complaints to City Administrator Keith Brady. Shortly after, Ferguson was demoted to night patrol on the weekends. Her complaint describes this as retaliation by the police department for trying to bring sexism to light. In July, Ferguson filed a sexual harassment complaint with the Federal Equal Opportunity Employment Commission. The city hired an investigator to look into her EEOC case and received those results in October. Ferguson was not given a copy of the report. Her lawsuit further states that she then received a letter from the city of Sitka stating that her demotion was for, quote, legitimate business reasons. Her lawsuit serves Ankerfeldt, the city of Sitka, and the Sitka Police Department. She is represented by the Northern Justice Project, an Anchorage-based civil rights firm that is also representing Detective Ryan Silva. Silva filed suit against the police department in August, alleging that he too was demoted when he blew the whistle about the improper procurement of automatic weapons and for his support of Ferguson in her complaint. According to his brief, the two are in a relationship and now live together. Reached for comment, City Attorney Brian Hansen said the city has accepted service on this case and confirmed insurance coverage. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
The Federal Drug Enforcement Administration is teaming with local agencies on an opioid summit in Fairbanks
to take control of the problem and get our communities back.
DEA Seattle Field Office Diversion Program Manager Ricardo Quintero describes a long-running nationwide problem the agency helps communities address with events like the two-day summit in Fairbanks. One of the day one presenters was Fairbanks Substance Abuse Counselor Gunnar Ebbison, who co-chaired a state opioid task force. Ebbison points to the increasing severity of Alaska's epidemic.
In our state in 2016, there were 16 overdose deaths. In the year between July 1st, 2017 and June 31st, 2018, there were 81. And so that's like a fourfold increase.
Ebbison traces the nationwide problem back to the 1990s when doctors increasingly prescribed opioid-containing medications to reduce patient pain. He says that leads to abuse of pills like OxyContin, often leading to heroin. Ebbison says one of the state's strategies to combat the problem is mass distribution of the opioid overdose drug Narcan, but also points to the importance of follow-up medications and counseling
to change their lives and get out of the cycle of addiction.
Jamie Sawchuk supervises a Fairbanks Native Association opioid treatment program. Sawchuk, who began her job this spring, says she was surprised by the breadth of the local program.
It's not just, you know, older adults, as it's commonly believed, who are abusing their medication, but it's young kids in high school.
Fairbanks North Star Borough School District Assistant Superintendent Sean Kraska says opioids are far less prevalent than alcohol and marijuana, but are an issue.
I would say at this point, the way we are seeing most opioids that we engage with in some manner because kids have made a poor choice to use or bring them to school is in the example of prescription drugs.
Kraska says the district is trying to be on the front end of the issue, and that includes intervention and prevention. local tribal authorities in Togiak seized approximately $32,000 of alcohol last Thursday. Acting on a tip that alcohol was being smuggled into the dry village via air cargo, tribal police officers confiscated 81 750 milliliter bottles and 7 1-gallon jugs of whiskey disguised in apple juice containers. Investigation into the incident is ongoing. Dillingham-based trooper Justin Hilario says that tips like the one received in this case are vital to law enforcement in Bristol Bay.
Besides us doing our random checks at the different airports and air terminals, we work off of a lot of tips that we can receive from the community. We try to follow up on every tip that we do get, and whereas we can't be everywhere at once, efforts and tips from the community help us out a lot.
It is illegal to sell, import, or possess alcohol in Togiak, which is a local option community.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
Flooding has closed schools, roads, and air traffic in Seward. The Anchorage Daily News reports 3.5 inches of rain fell on Seward in 24 hours starting at noon Monday. More than 5 inches fell at nearby Exit Glacier, and the city airport received nearly that much. City Clerk Brenda Ballow says standing water over most of the runway closed the airport. The city declared an emergency. Seward Elementary, Middle, and High Schools released students early and canceled after-school activities. Crews are working to keep Lowell Creek Bridge cleared of debris accompanying rising water levels. The Seward Police Department cautions residents to avoid flooded areas and to use caution around heavy equipment and machinery. Well, the overall population of Alaska has remained steady over the past 5 years, but in certain areas of the state, it's on the rise. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports some of those areas are Alaska's smallest communities.
The trend spreads across western and northern Alaska. Hub communities like Dillingham, Bethold, Nome, and Kotzebue are slowly increasing in population. But state demographer Eddie Hunsinger points out something he calls remarkable.
It's not the major population centers that are growing the most.
It's the villages. Many factors determine population. The basics are births, deaths, people moving in, and people moving out. The western and northern population is young. That means fewer deaths and more babies being born.
In, you know, western and northern regions of the state, there's typically some what we call net migration losses, more people leaving the region than moving to the region, but it's a little bit more than compensated for by the number of births.
The Lower Kuskokwim School District is feeling the effects. Many of its schools are overcrowded. Meanwhile, schools in other areas of the state are closing because there aren't enough students. State estimates show that in 2017, 40% of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta's population was under 20 years old. That same year shows 70% of the population under age 40. Here's some more numbers. In 2010, state estimates show Bethel representing a quarter of the YK Delta's overall population. By 2017, that number had dropped by 2 percentage points as village populations rose. This trend contrasts with other areas of the state that have much older populations, like Southeast Alaska, the Southern Kenai Peninsula, and the Haines Borough. Demographer Eddie Hunsinger cautions that collecting village population data has some limitations.
Household sort of living arrangements are a bit different than other parts of the state and the rest of the country.
Multiple families often live in one house, and people may claim multiple places as residents. Nevertheless, the upward population trend of the villages appears undeniable, but it has yet to eclipse the fastest growing area of the state. That distinction belongs to the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Petersburg's Borough Assembly last night voted down a resolution calling for a forensic audit of 2 Tongass National Forest timber sales. The Assembly back in May also voted against sending a letter on lost revenue from the sales and the impact to Petersburg. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
The issue has been prompted by a 2016 review by staff of the U.S. Forest Service's Washington office that noted timber companies were focusing on the more valuable trees. According to that review, that practice resulted in millions of dollars of lost value from the contracts for the Tonka sale on Kuprinoff Island near Petersburg and the Big Thorn sale on Prince of Wales Island. The sales are what are called integrated resource contracts, meaning that money would have been kept on the Tongass to pay for stream restoration and culvert repair and other stewardship work. Becky Knight has been among the local residents asking the Assembly to pass such a resolution seeking answers.
I respectfully ask that you unanimously support the resolution. To vote otherwise would send a clear message that not only is the timber industry a sacred cow, but there are no budgetary issues facing our community, and we are willing to allow millions of dollars to evaporate.
The timber sale problems were highlighted by the group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, a nationwide watchdog group based in Silver Spring, Maryland. PEER published the 2016 Forest Service review of the sales and sued the agency for documents relating to Tongass timber sale administration and appraisal. PEER says it's received thousands of pages of Forest Service documents and communications, but says it has not yet seen evidence of change in sale oversight. The Forest Service has said it is implementing a plan to address the Washington office review findings. Assemblymember and retired Forest Service employee Bob Lynn was against the resolution and said he understood the agency was already following up on the problems.
From a borough standpoint, I think we need to look at it from a positive way. And the positive way would be to write a letter asking, first of all, if we wanted to, maybe the Chief of the Forest Service or the Secretary of Agriculture to give us an update on what is going on and when we can expect some results.
It was Lynn's first meeting back on the Assembly. He was off for a year and not part of the vote back in May against sending such a letter. Assemblymember Jeff Mucci asked for the resolution to be back on the agenda at this time.
Now we have an opportunity to kind of move this thing forward. If somebody would like to submit a letter to the Forest Service, we can certainly do that, but this has been out there for a while. It can't hurt to ask.
The votes weren't there to pass the resolution this time around. Only Mucci and J. Stanton Greger supported it. It failed by a 2-4 vote. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Emily Kwong in Sitka, June Leffler in Wrangell, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, and Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Annie Fight produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.